I suppose you're happy it's not Otsu, but don't think I've forgotten that you were the unholy matchmaker who threw her together with Musashi and caused all this trouble in the first place. If that's the way you feel, fine. But I know you're a woman with religious faith, and I say you shouldn't go away and leave this body lying here. He was stretched out there, on the verge of death anyway. Matahachi killed him, but it wasn't Matahachi's fault.
This ronin, said the innkeeper, was a little peculiar in the head. For the last few days, he's been staggering around town, drooling at the mouth. He had a huge lump on his head. Displaying an absolute lack of concern, Osugi turned to leave. Takuan asked the innkeeper to take care of the corpse and followed her, much to Osugi's annoyance. But as she turned to unleash her poisonous tongue again, Matahachi called softly,
"Mother?"
She went happily toward the voice. He was a good son after all. He had stayed to make sure his mother was safe. Whispering a few words to each other, they apparently decided they were not completely free from danger in the priest's presence and ran as fast as they could toward the foot of the hill.
"It's no use," murmured Takuan. "To judge from that performance, they wouldn't listen to anything I have to say. If only the world could be rid of silly misunderstandings, how much less people would suffer."
But right now, he had to find Otsu. She had discovered some means of escaping. His spirits rose a little, but he could not really relax until he was sure she was safe. He decided to continue his search despite the darkness. The innkeeper had gone up the hill a while earlier. He came back down accompanied by 7 or 8 men with lanterns. The night watchman at the temple, having agreed to help with the burial, brought shovels and spades. Presently, Takuan heard the unpleasant sound of grave digging. About the time the hole was deep enough, someone cried, "Look over here! Another body! This one's a pretty young girl!" The man was about 10 yards from the grave on the edge of a marsh. "Is she dead?"
"No, just unconscious."
The Urbane Craftsman. Until his dying day, Musashi's father had never stopped reminding him of his ancestry.
"I may be only a country samurai," he'd say, "but never forget, the Akamatsu clan was once famous and powerful. It should be a source of strength and pride to you."
Since he was in Kyoto, Musashi decided to visit a temple called the Rakanji, near which the Akamatsus had once had a house. The clan had long since fallen, but it was just possible he might find at the temple some record of his ancestors. Even if he didn't, he could burn some incense in their memory. Arriving at the Rakan Bridge over the lower Kogawa, he thought that he must be near the temple, for it was said to be located a little east of where the upper Kogawa became the lower Kogawa. His inquiries in the neighborhood, however, drew a complete blank. No one had ever heard of it. Returning to the bridge, he stood and gazed at the clear, shallow water flowing beneath it. Though it wasn't so many years since Munisai's death, it appeared that the temple had been either moved or destroyed, leaving neither trace nor memory. He watched idly as a whitish eddy formed and disappeared again. Noticing mud dripping from a grassy spot on the left bank, he concluded that it came from a sword polisher's shop.
"Musashi!"
He looked around and saw the old nun Myoshu returning from an errand.
"How good of you to come!" she exclaimed, thinking he was there to pay a call. "Koetsu's at home today. He'll be glad to see you."
She led him through the gate of a nearby house and sent a servant to fetch her son. After warmly welcoming his guest, Koetsu said,
"At the moment, I'm busy with an important polishing job, but later we can have a nice long chat."
It pleased Musashi to see that both mother and son were as friendly and natural as they had been the first time he met them. He spent the afternoon and evening chatting with them, and when they urged him to spend the night, he accepted. The next day, while Koetsu showed him the workshop and explained the technique of sword polishing, he begged Musashi to stay on as long as he wished. The house, with its deceptively modest gate, stood on a corner southeast of the remains of the Jisoin. In the neighborhood were several houses belonging to Koetsu's cousins and nephews, or to other men engaged in the same profession. All the Hongamis lived and worked here, after the fashion of the large provincial clans of the past. The Hongamis were descended from a fairly distinguished military family, and had been retainers to the Ashikaga shoguns. In the present social hierarchy, the family belonged to the artisan class, but insofar as wealth and prestige were concerned, Koetsu might have been taken for a member of the samurai class. He hobnobbed with high court nobles and had on occasion been invited by Tokugawa Ieyasu to Fushimi Castle. The Hongami's position was not unique. Most of the wealthy artisans and merchants of the day, Suminokura Soan, Chaya Shirojiro, and Haya Shoyu, among others, were of samurai descent. Under the Ashikaga shoguns, their ancestors had been assigned work related to manufacture or trade. Success in these fields led to a gradual severing of connections with the military class, and as private enterprise became profitable, they were no longer dependent on their feudal emoluments. Although their social rank was technically lower than that of the warriors, they were very powerful. When it came to business, not only was samurai status more of a hindrance than a help, there were definite advantages to being a commoner, chief of which was stability. When fighting erupted, the great merchants were patronized by both sides. True, they were sometimes forced to furnish military supplies for little or nothing, but they had come to regard this onus as no more than a fee paid in lieu of having their property destroyed during wartime. During the Onin War of the 1460s and 70s, the whole district around the ruins of the Jisoin had been razed, and even now, people planting trees often dug up rusted fragments of swords or helmets. The Hongami residence had been one of the first built in the vicinity after the war. A branch of the Arisugawa flowed through the compound, meandering first through a quarter acre or so of vegetable garden, then disappearing into a grove to emerge again near the well by the front entrance of the main house. There was a branch flowing off toward the kitchen, another toward the bath, and still another toward a simple rustic tea house, where the clear water was used for the tea ceremony. The river was the source of water for the workshop, where swords forged by master craftsmen like Masamune, Muramasa, and Osafune were expertly polished. Since the workshop was sacred to the family, a rope was suspended over the entranceway in the manner of Shinto shrines. Almost before he knew it, 4 days passed, and Musashi made up his mind to take his leave. But before he'd had a chance to mention this, Koetsu said, "We're not doing much to entertain you, but if you're not bored, please stay as long as you like. There are some old books and curios in my study. If you'd like to look them over, feel free to do so. And in a day or two, I'm going to fire some tea bowls and dishes. You might enjoy watching. You'll find ceramics almost as interesting as swords. Maybe you could model a piece or two yourself." Touched by the graciousness of the invitation and his host's assurance that no one would take offense if he decided to leave on a moment's notice, Musashi allowed himself to settle down and enjoy the relaxed atmosphere. He was far from bored. The study contained books in Chinese and Japanese, scroll paintings from the Kamakura period, rubbings of calligraphy by ancient Chinese masters, and dozens of other things, any one of which Musashi could happily have pored over for a day or so. He was particularly attracted by a painting hanging in the alcove, called Chestnuts, It was by the Sung master Liang Kai. It was small, about 2 feet high by 2.5 wide, and so old that it was impossible to tell what sort of paper it was drawn on. He sat and gazed at it by the hour. Finally, one day, he remarked to Koetsu, "I'm sure no rank amateur could paint the sort of pictures you paint, but I wonder if maybe even I couldn't draw something as simple as this work."
"It's the other way around," Koetsu informed him. "Anybody could learn to paint as well as I, but there is a degree of profundity and spiritual loftiness in Liang Kai's painting that cannot be acquired merely by studying art."
"Is that really true?" Musashi asked in surprise. He was assured that it was. It showed nothing but a squirrel looking at 2 fallen chestnuts, one split open and the other tightly closed, as if it wanted to follow its natural impulse and eat the chestnuts, but hesitated for fear of the thorns. Since the painting was executed very freely in black ink, Musashi had thought it looked naive. But the more he looked at it after talking to Koetsu, the more clearly he saw that the artist was right. One afternoon, Koetsu came in and said, "Are you staring at Liang Kai's picture again? You seem to have taken a great liking to it. When you leave, roll it up and take it with you. I'd like you to have it." Musashi demurred. "I couldn't possibly accept it. It's bad enough for me to stay here in your house so long. Why, that must be a family heirloom." "But you do like it, don't you?" The older man smiled indulgently. "You may have it if you want it. I really don't need it. Pictures should be owned by the people who really love and appreciate them. I'm sure that's what the artist would want."
"If you put it that way, I'm not the one to own a painting like this. To tell the truth, I've thought several times it'd be nice to have it. But if I did, what would I do with it? I'm only a wandering swordsman. I never stay in the same place very long."
"I suppose it would be a nuisance, carrying a painting around with you wherever you go. At your age, you probably don't even want a house of your own. But I think every man should have a place he can regard as home, even if it's nothing more than a little shack. Without a house, a person gets lonely, feels lost somehow. Why don't you find some logs and build a cabin in some quiet corner of the city?"
"I never thought about it. I'd like to travel to a lot of distant places, go to the farthest end of Kyushu and see how people live under the foreign influences in Nagasaki. And I'm eager to see the new capital the shogun is building in Edo and the great mountains and rivers in northern Honshu. Maybe I'm just a vagabond at heart."
"You're not the only one, by any means. It's only natural. But you should avoid the temptation of thinking that your dreams can be realized only in some far-off place. If you think that way, you'll neglect the possibilities in your immediate surroundings."
"Most young people do, I fear, and become dissatisfied with their lives."
Koetsu laughed.
"But an idle old man like myself has no business preaching to the young. Anyway, I didn't come here to talk about that. I came to invite you out this evening. Have you ever been to the licensed quarter?"
"The geisha district?"
"Yes. I've a friend named Haya Shoyu. Despite his age, he's always up to some mischief or other. I just received a note inviting me to join him near Rokujo Avenue this evening, and I wondered if you'd like to come along."
"No, I don't think so."
"If you really don't want to, I'll not insist, but I think you'd find it interesting."
Myoshu, who had crept in silently and was listening with obvious interest, put in,
"I think you should go, Musashi. It's an opportunity to see something you haven't seen. Haya Shoyu's not the kind of man you have to be stiff and formal with, and I believe you'd enjoy the experience. By all means, go.
The old nun went to the chest of drawers and began taking out a kimono and obi. As a rule, older people were at pains to prevent young men from frittering away their time and money at geisha houses, but Myoshu seemed as enthusiastic as if she herself were getting ready to go somewhere.
"Now, let's see. Which of these kimonos do you like?" she asked. "Will this obi do?"
Chattering away, she busied herself getting out things for Musashi as if he were her son. She chose a lacquered pillbox, a decorative short sword, and a brocade wallet, then took some gold coins from the money chest and slipped them into the wallet. "Well," said Musashi, with only a trace of reluctance, "if you insist, I'll go, but I wouldn't look right in all that finery. I'll just wear this old kimono I have on. I sleep in it when I'm out in the open. I'm used to it."
"You'll do no such thing," Myoshu said sternly. "You yourself may not mind, but think of the other people. In those nice pretty rooms, you'd look no better than a dirty old rag. Men go there to have a good time and forget their troubles. They want to be surrounded by beautiful things. Don't think of it as dressing up to make yourself look like something you're not. Anyway, these clothes aren't nearly as fancy as some men wear. They're just clean and neat. Now, put them on."
Musashi complied. When he was dressed, Myoshu remarked cheerfully,
"There, you look very handsome."
As they were about to leave, Koetsu went to the household Buddhist altar and lit a candle on it. Both he and his mother were devout members of the Nichiren sect. At the front entrance, Myoshu had laid out two pairs of sandals with new thongs. While they were putting them on, she whispered with one of the servants, who was waiting to shut the front gate after them. Koetsu said goodbye to his mother, but she looked up at him quickly and said,
"Wait just a minute."
Her face was creased in a worried frown.
"What's the matter?"
he asked.
"This man tells me three rough-looking samurai were just here and spoke very rudely. Do you suppose it's anything important?"
Koetsu looked questioningly at Musashi.
"There's no reason to be afraid," Musashi assured him. "They're probably from the house of Yoshioka. They may attack me, but they don't have anything against you."
"One of the workmen said the same sort of thing happened a couple of days ago. Only one samurai, but he came through the gate without being asked and looked over the hedge by the tea house path, toward the part of the house where you're staying."
"Then I'm sure it's the Yoshioka men."
"I think so too," agreed Koetsu.
He turned to the trembling gateman.
"What did they say?"
"The workmen had all left, and I was about to close the gate when these three samurai suddenly surrounded me. One of them, he looked mean, took a letter out of his kimono and ordered me to hand it to the guest staying here."
"He didn't say Musashi?"
"Well, later on he did say Miyamoto Musashi, and he said Musashi'd been staying here for several days."
"What did you say?"
"You said not to tell anyone about Musashi, so I shook my head and said there was no one here by that name. He got angry and called me a liar, but one of the others, a somewhat older man with a smirk on his face, calmed him down and said they'd find a way to deliver the letter directly. I'm not sure what he meant, but it sounded like a threat. They went off toward the corner down there."
"Koetsu, you walk on a little ahead of me," said Musashi. "I don't want you to get hurt or become involved in any trouble because of me."
Koetsu replied with a laugh.
"There's no need to worry about me, particularly if you're sure they're Yoshioka men. I'm not the least bit afraid of them. Let's go."
After they were outside, Koetsu put his head back through the small door in the gate and called,
"Mother!"
"Did you forget something?"
she asked.
"No, I was just thinking. If you're worried about me, I could send a messenger to show you and tell him I can't come this evening."
"Oh, no. I'm more afraid something might happen to Musashi. But I don't think he'd come back if you tried to stop him. Go on and have a good time."
Koetsu caught up with Musashi and, as they ambled along the riverbank, said,
"Shoyu's house is just down the road at Ichijo Avenue and Horikawa Street. He's probably getting ready now, so let's stop in for him. It's right on the way."
It was still light, and the walk along the river was pleasant, all the more so because they were completely at leisure at an hour when everybody else was busy. Musashi remarked,
"I've heard Haya Shoyu's name, but I really don't know anything about him."
"I'd be surprised if you hadn't heard of him. He's a well-known expert at composing linked verse."
"Ah, so he's a poet."
"He is, but of course he doesn't make his living writing verse. He comes from an old Kyoto merchant family."
"How did he get the name Haya?"
"It's the name of his business."
"What does he sell?"
"His name means ash salesman, and that's what he sells. Ashes."
"Ashes?"
"Yes, they're used in dyeing cloth. It's a big business. He sells to dyers' guilds all over the country. At the beginning of the Ashikaga period, the ash trade was controlled by an agent of the shogun, but later it was turned over to private wholesalers. There are three big wholesale houses in Kyoto, and Shoyu's is one of them. He himself doesn't have to work, of course. He's retired and living a life of ease. Look over there. You can see his house. It's the one with the stylish gate." Musashi nodded as he listened, but his attention was distracted by the feel of his sleeves. While the right one was waving lightly in the breeze, the left did not move at all. Slipping his hand in, he drew out an object enough to see what it was, a well-tanned purple leather thong of the type warriors use to tie up their sleeves when fighting.
"Myoshu," he thought. "Only she could have put it there."
He looked back and smiled at the men behind them, who, as he was already aware, had been trailing along at a discreet distance ever since he and Koetsu had turned out of Honami Lane. His smile seemed to relieve the three men. They whispered a few words to each other and began taking longer strides. Coming to the Haya house, Koetsu sounded the clapper on the gate, and a servant carrying a broom came to admit them. Koetsu was through the gate and in the front garden before he noticed Musashi was not with him. Turning back toward the gate, he called,
"Come in, Musashi. There's nothing to be hesitant about."
Having closed in on Musashi, the three samurai had their elbows thrust out and their hands on their swords. Koetsu couldn't catch what they said to Musashi, nor the latter's soft reply. Musashi told him not to wait, and Koetsu answered with an air of complete calm,
"All right, I'll be in the house. Join me as soon as you've finished your business."
"We're not here," one of the men said, "to argue about whether you ran away to hide or not. I'm Otaguro Hyosuke. I'm one of the 10 swordsmen of the House of Yoshioka. I've brought a letter from Seijuro's younger brother, Denshichiro."
Taking the letter out, he held it up for Musashi to see.
"Read it, and give us your answer immediately."
Opening the letter in an offhand manner, Musashi read it quickly and said, "I accept." Hyosuke looked at him suspiciously.
"Are you sure?"
Musashi nodded.
"Absolutely sure."
Musashi's casualness took them off guard.
"If you don't keep your word, you'll never be able to show your face in Kyoto again. We'll see to that."
Musashi's stare was accompanied by a slight smile, but he said nothing.
"Are you satisfied with the conditions? There's not much time left to prepare yourself."
"I'm quite ready," Musashi answered calmly.
"Then we'll see you later this evening."
As Musashi started through the gate, Hyosuke approached him again and asked,
"Will you be here until the time agreed on?"
"No, my host is taking me to the licensed quarter near Rokujo Avenue."
"The licensed quarter?"
Hyosuke was surprised.
"Well, I assume you'll be either here or there. If you're late, I'll send someone for you. I trust you won't try any tricks."
Musashi had already turned his back and entered the front garden, a step that took him into a different world. The irregularly shaped artlessly spaced stepping stones of the garden path appeared to have been put there by nature. On either side were moist clumps of low, fern-like bamboo, interspersed with taller bamboo shoots, no thicker than a riding brush. As he walked on, the roof of the main house came into view, then the front entrance, a small separate house, and a garden bower, each contributing to the atmosphere of venerable age and long tradition. Around the buildings, tall pines suggested wealth and comfort. He could hear people playing the game of kickball called kemari, a soft, sporadic thump, often heard from behind the walls of the mansions of court nobles. Hearing it in a merchant's establishment surprised him. Once in the house, he was shown into a room looking out onto the garden. Two servants entered with tea and cakes, one informing them that their host would be with them shortly. Musashi could tell from the servants' manner that they were impeccably trained. Koetsu murmured, "It's quite cold, isn't it, now that the sun's gone down?" He wanted to have the shoji closed, but didn't ask because Musashi appeared to be enjoying the view of the plum blossoms. Koetsu also turned his eyes toward the view. "I see there are clouds above Mount Hiei," he remarked. "I'd guess they're from the north. Aren't you chilly?" "No, not especially," answered Musashi honestly, serenely ignorant of what his companion was hinting at. A servant brought a candlestick, and Koetsu took the opportunity to close the shoji. Musashi became conscious of the atmosphere within the household, which was peaceful and genial. Relaxing and listening to the laughing voices coming from the inner part of the house, he was struck by the complete absence of ostentation. It was as though the decor and surroundings had deliberately been made as simply as possible. He could imagine himself in the guest room of a large farmhouse in the country. Heiya Shoyu entered the room and proclaimed, "I'm sorry to have kept you waiting so long." His voice, open, friendly, youthful, was just the opposite of Koetsu's soft drawl. Thin as a crane, he was perhaps 10 years older than his friend, yet far more jovial. When Koetsu explained who Musashi was, he said, "Oh, so you're a nephew of Matsuo Kaname. I know him quite well." Shoyu's acquaintance with his uncle must have been through the noble house of Konoe, thought Musashi, beginning to sense the close ties between the wealthy merchants and the palace courtiers. Without further ado, the spry old merchant said, "Let's be on our way. I'd intended to go while it was still light so that we could stroll over, but since it's already dark, I think we should call for palanquins. This young man's coming with us, I assume?" Palanquins were summoned, and the three set off, Shoyu and Koetsu in front, Musashi behind. It was the first time he had ever ridden in one. By the time they reached the Yanagi riding grounds, the bearers were already puffing white steam.
"Oh, it's cold," one complained.
"The wind cuts into you, doesn't it?
And it's supposed to be spring."
Their three lanterns swung to and fro, flickering in the wind. Dark clouds above the city hinted ominously of still worse weather before the night was out. Beyond the riding field, the lights of the city shone in dazzling splendor. Musashi had the impression of a great swarm of fireflies glowing cheerfully in the cold, clear breeze.
"Musashi!" Koetsu called from the middle palanquin. "That's where we're going, over there! It's quite an experience to come upon it suddenly, isn't it?"
He explained that until 3 years ago, the licensed district had been at Nijo Avenue near the palace. Then the magistrate, Itakura Katsushige, had had it moved because the nightly singing and carousing was a nuisance. He said the whole area was thriving and that all new fashions originated within those rows of lights.
"You could almost say that a whole new culture has been created there." Pausing and listening carefully for a moment, he added, "You can just hear it, can't you? The sound of strings and singing?"
It was music Musashi had never heard before.
The instruments are shamisen. They're an improved version of a three-stringed instrument brought from the Ryukyu Islands. A great many new songs have been composed for them, all right here in the quarter, then spread out among the common people. So you can see how influential this district is, and why certain standards of decency have to be maintained, even though it's rather cut off from the rest of the city.
They turned into one of the streets, the light from countless bright lamps and lanterns hanging from the willow trees reflected in Musashi's eyes. The district had kept its old name when it was moved, Yanagimachi, the town of willows, willows having long been associated with drinking and dalliance. Koetsu and Shoyu were well known at the establishment they entered. The greetings were obsequious, yet jocular, and it soon became apparent that they used nicknames, play names, as it were. Koetsu was known as Mizuochi-sama, Mr. Falling Water, because of the streams traversing his estate, and Shoyu was Funabashi-sama, Mr. Boat Bridge, after a pontoon bridge in the vicinity of his house. If Musashi was to become a habitué, he would certainly acquire a nickname soon, for in this never-never land, few use their real names. Hayashiya Yojibe was only the pseudonym of the proprietor of the house they were visiting, but more often than not, he was called Ogiya, the name of the establishment. Along with the Kikyoya, it was one of the two best-known houses in the district, the only two, in fact, with the reputation of being absolutely first-class. The reigning beauty at the Ogiya was Yoshino Dayu, and her counterpart at the Kikyoya, Murogimi Dayu. Both ladies enjoyed a degree of fame in the city rivaled only by that of the greatest daimyo. Although Musashi studiously attempted not to gape, he was astonished by the elegance of his surroundings, which approached that of the most opulent palaces. The reticular ceilings, ornately carved openwork transoms, exquisite curved railings, fastidiously tended inner gardens, everything was a feast for the eye. Absorbed in a painting on a wooden door panel, he did not notice that his companions had gone on ahead until Koetsu came back for him. The silver-colored doors of the room they entered were transformed into a hazy liquid by the light of the lamps. One side opened onto a garden in the style of Koborienshu, well-raked sand and a rock arrangement suggestive of Chinese mountain scenery, such as one might see in a Sung painting. Shoyu, complaining of the cold, sat down on a cushion and drew his shoulders together. Koetsu also seated himself and bade Musashi to do likewise. Serving girls soon arrived with warm sake. Seeing that the cup he had urged on Musashi had cooled off, Shoyu became insistent. "Drink up, young man," he said, "and have a hot cup." After this refrain had been repeated two or three times, Shoyu's manner began to border on rudeness. "Kobosatsu," he said to one of the serving girls, "make him drink. You, Musashi, what's the matter with you? Why aren't you drinking?" "I am," protested Musashi. The old man was already a little tipsy.
"Well, you're not doing very well. You don't have any spirit."
"I'm not much of a drinker."
"What you mean is that you're not a strong swordsman, isn't it?"
"Maybe that's true," said Musashi mildly, laughing off the insult.
"If you're worried about drinking interfering with your studies, or throwing you off balance, or weakening your willpower, or preventing you from making a name for yourself, then you haven't got the pluck to be a fighter."
"Oh, it's not that. There's only one small problem."
"What might that be?"
"It makes me sleepy."
"Well, you can go to sleep here or anywhere else in the place. No one will mind."
Turning to the girls, he said,
"The young man's afraid he'll get drowsy if he drinks. If he gets sleepy, put him to bed."
"Oh, we'll be glad to,"
chorused the girls, smiling coyly.
If he goes to bed, someone will have to keep him warm. Koetsu, which one should it be?
Which one, indeed, said Koetsu, noncommittally.
It can't be Sumigiku Dayu. She's my little wife. And you yourself wouldn't want it to be Kobasatsu Dayu. There's Karakoto Dayu. She won't do. She's too hard to get along with.
Isn't Yoshino Dayu going to put in an appearance? Asked Koetsu.
That's it! She's just the one. Even our reluctant guest should be happy with her. I wonder why she isn't here now. Someone go call her. I want to show her to the young samurai here.
Sumigiku objected. Yoshino's not like the rest of us. She has many clients, and she won't come running at just anyone's beck and call.
Oh, yes she will, for me. Tell her I'm here, and she'll come, no matter who she happens to be with. Go and call her.
Shoyu reared up, looked around, and called to the young girls who attended the courtesans and were now playing in the next room.
Is Linya there?
Linya herself answered.
Come here a minute. You wait on Yoshino Dayu, don't you? Why isn't she here? Tell her Funabashi is here. She should come right away. If you bring her back with you, I'll give you a present.
Linya looked a little puzzled. Her eyes opened wide, but after a moment, she signaled her assent. She already showed signs of becoming a great beauty, and it was almost certain she would be the successor in the next generation to the famous Yoshino. But she was only 11 years old. Barely had she gone into the outside corridor and slid the door shut when she clapped her hands and called loudly,
Uneme! Tamami! Itonosuke! Look out here!
The three girls rushed out and began clapping their hands and shrieking joyfully, delighted by the discovery of snow outside. The men looked out to see what the commotion was about, and, except for Shoyu, were amused by the sight of the young attendants chattering excitedly, trying to decide whether the snow would still be on the ground in the morning. Linya, her mission forgotten, rushed out into the garden to play in the snow. Impatient, Shoyu sent out one of the courtesans in search of Yoshino Dayu. She returned and whispered into his ear,
Yoshino said she would like more than anything to join you, but her guest won't permit it.
Won't permit it? That's ridiculous! Other women here may be forced to do their customers' bidding, but Yoshino can do as she pleases. Or is she allowing herself to be bought for money these days?
Oh, no, but the guest she's with tonight is particularly stubborn. Every time she says she'd like to leave, he insists more adamantly that she stay.
I suppose none of her customers ever wants her to go. Who is she with tonight?
Lord Karasumaru.
Lord Karasumaru?
Repeated Shoyu with an ironic smile.
Is he alone?
No.
He's with some of his usual cronies?
Yes.
Shoyu slapped his knee.
This might turn out to be interesting. The snow is good, the sake is good, and if we just had Yoshino, everything would be perfect. Koetsu, let's write his lordship a letter. You, young lady, bring me an inkstone and brush.
When the girl placed the writing materials before Koetsu, he said,
What shall I write?
A poem would be good. Prose might do, but verse would be better. Lord Karasumaru is one of our more celebrated poets.
I'm not sure I know how to go about it. Let's see. We want the poem to persuade him to let us have Yoshino. Isn't that right?
That's it.
If it's not a good poem, it won't make him change his mind. Good poems are not easy to write on the spur of the moment. Why don't you write the first lines, and I'll write the rest?
Let's see what we can do.
Shoyu took the brush and wrote, To our humble hut, let there come one cherry tree, one tree from Yoshino.
So far, so good, said Koetsu, and wrote,
The flowers shiver from cold in the clouds above the peaks. Shoyu was immensely pleased.
Marvelous, he said. That ought to take care of his lordship and his noble companions. The people above the clouds.
He neatly folded the paper, then handed it to Sumigiku, saying gravely,
The other girls don't seem to have the dignity you have, so I appoint you my envoy to Lord Kangang. If I'm not mistaken, that's the name he's known by in these parts.
The nickname, meaning Frigid Mountain Crag, was a reference to Lord Karasumaru's exalted status. Sumigiku was not long in returning.
Lord Kangan's reply, if you please, she said, reverentially placing a gorgeously wrought letterbox before Shoyu and Koetsu.
They looked at the box, which implied formality, then at each other. What had started as a little joke was taking on more serious overtones.
My word, said Shoyu, we must be more careful next time. They must have been surprised. Surely they couldn't have known we'd be here tonight.
Still hoping to get the better of the exchange, Shoyu opened the box and unfolded the answer. To his dismay, he saw nothing but a piece of cream-colored paper, devoid of writing. Thinking he must have dropped something, he looked around for a second sheet, then glanced again into the box.
Sumigiku, what does this mean?
I have no idea. Lord Kangang handed me the box and told me to give it to you.
Is he trying to make asses of us? Or was our poem too clever for him and he's raising the white flag of surrender?
Shoyu had a way of interpreting things to suit his own convenience, but this time he appeared uncertain. He handed the paper to Koetsu and asked,
What do you make of it?
I think he intends us to read it.
Read a blank piece of paper?
I should think it can be construed somehow.
Do you? What could it possibly mean?
Koetsu thought for a moment.
Snow. Snow covering everything.
Maybe you're right.
In answer to our request for a cherry tree from Yoshino, it could mean, if you gaze at snow and fill your cup with sake, even without flowers. In other words, he's telling us that since it's snowing tonight, we should forget about love, open the doors, and admire the snow as we drink. Or at least that's my impression.
How annoying! Exclaimed Shoyu with distaste. I have no intention of drinking in such a heartless fashion. Not going to sit here and be silent either. One way or another, we'll transplant the Yoshino tree to our room and admire her blossoms.
Excited now, he moistened his lips with his tongue. Koetsu humored him, hoping he would calm down, but Shoyu kept after the girls to bring Yoshino and refused to allow the subject to be changed for very long. Though his persistence did not secure his wish, it eventually became comical, and the girls rolled on the floor with laughter. Musashi quietly left his seat. He had chosen the right time. No one noticed his departure. Reverberations in the Snow. Musashi wandered about the many hallways, avoiding the brightly lit front parlors. He came upon one dark room where bedding was kept and another full of tools and implements. The walls seemed to exude the warmish odor of food being prepared, but still he could not find the kitchen. An attendant came out of one room and held her arms to block his way.
Sir, guests aren't supposed to come back here. She said firmly, with none of the childish cuteness she might have affected in the guest rooms.
Oh, shouldn't I be here?
Certainly not.
She gave him a shove toward the front and walked in the same direction herself.
Aren't you the girl who fell in the snow a while ago? Rinya, isn't it?
Yes, I'm Rinya. I suppose you got lost trying to find the toilet. I'll show you where it is.
She took his hand and pulled.
That's not it. I'm not drunk. I'd like you to do me a favor. Take me to an empty room and bring me some food.
Food?
If that's what you want, I'll take it to your parlor.
No, not there. Everybody's having a good time. They don't want to be reminded of dinner yet. Linya cocked her head.
I suppose you're right. I'll bring you something here. What would you like?
Nothing special. 2 large rice balls will do. She returned in a few minutes with the rice balls and served them to him in an unlit room. When he had finished, he said, I guess I can get out of the house through the inner garden there. Without waiting for a reply, he stood up and walked to the veranda.
Where are you going, sir?
Don't worry, I'll be back soon.
Why are you leaving by the back way?
People would make a fuss if I went out the front way, and if my host saw me, it would upset them and spoil their fun.
I'll open the gate for you, but be sure to come back right away. If you don't, they'll blame me.
I understand. If Mr. Mizuochi should ask about me, tell him I went to the neighborhood of the Renge Oing to see a man I know. I intend to return shortly.
You must come back soon.
Your companion for the evening is to be Yoshino Dayu. She opened the snow-laden folding wooden gate and let him out. Directly opposite the main entrance to the gay quarter was a tea shop called the Amigasa Jaya. Musashi stopped and asked for a pair of straw sandals, but they had none. As the name implied, their chief business was selling basket hats to men who wished to conceal their identity when entering the quarter. After sending the shop girl to buy sandals, he sat down on the edge of a stool and tightened his obi and the cord under it. Removing his loose-fitting coat and folding it neatly, he borrowed paper and brush and wrote a brief note, folded it, and slipped it into the sleeve of the coat. He then called to the old man crouched beside the hearth in the room behind the shop, whom he took to be the proprietor. Would you keep this coat for me? If I don't return by 11 o'clock, please take it to the Ogia and give it to a man called Koetsu. There's a letter for him inside the sleeve. The man said he'd be glad to help, and on being asked, informed Musashi it was only about 7 o'clock, the watchman having just passed and announced the hour. When the girl returned with the sandals, Musashi examined the thongs to make sure the plate was not too tight, then tied them on over his leather socks. Handing the shopkeeper more money than was necessary, he picked up a new basket hat and went outside. Instead of tying the hat on, he held it over his head to keep off the snow, which fell in flakes softer than cherry blossoms. Lights were visible along the riverbank at Shijo Avenue, but to the east, in the Gion Woods, it was pitch black, except for widely scattered patches of light from stone lanterns. The deathly stillness was broken only sporadically by the noise of snow sliding off a branch. In front of a shrine gate, about 20 men knelt in prayer, facing the deserted buildings. The temple bells in the nearby hills had just pealed 5 times, marking the hour of 8. On this particular night, the loud, clear sound of the bells seemed to penetrate to the pit of the stomach.
"That's enough praying," said Denshiro. "Let's be on our way."
As they started off, one of the men asked Denshiro if the thongs of his sandals were all right.
"On a freezing night like this, if they're too tight, they'll break." "They're fine. When it's this cold, the only thing to do is use cloth thongs. You'd better remember that."
At the shrine, Denshiro had completed his battle preparations, down to the headband and the leather sleeve thong. Surrounded by his grim-faced retinue, he strode across the snow, taking long, deep breaths and emitting puffs of white vapor. The challenge delivered to Musashi had specified the area behind the Renge Oing at 9 o'clock. Fearing, or professing to fear, that if they gave Musashi any extra time he might flee, never to return, the Yoshiokas had decided to act quickly. Kyosuke had remained in the vicinity of Shoyu's house, but had sent his 2 comrades to report on the situation. Approaching the Renge Oin, they saw a bonfire near the back of the temple.
"Who's that?"
asked Denshiro.
"It's probably Ryohei and Juro Zaimon." "They're here too?"
said Denshiro with a trace of annoyance.
There are too many of our men present. I don't want people saying Musashi lost only because he was attacked by a large force.
When the time comes, we'll go away.
The main temple building, the Sanju Sangendo, extended through 33 column spans. Behind it was a large open space, ideal for practicing archery and long used for that purpose. This association with one of the martial arts was what had induced Denshiro to choose the Renge Oin for his encounter with Musashi. Denshiro and his men were satisfied with the choice. There were some pine trees, enough to keep the landscape from being barren, but no weeds or rushes to get in the way during the course of the fight.
Ryohei and Juro Zaimon rose to greet Denshiro, Ryohei saying, "You've had a cold walk, I imagine. There's still plenty of time. Sit down and warm yourself."
Silently, Denshiro seated himself in the place Ryohei had vacated. He stretched his hands out over the flames and cracked his knuckles, one finger at a time.
"I guess I'm too early," he said.
His face, warmed by the fire, had already taken on a bloodthirsty look. Frowning, he asked,
"Didn't we pass a tea house on the way?"
"Yes, but it was closed."
"One of you, go and get some sake. If you knock long enough, they'll answer."
"Sake? Now?"
"Yes, now. I'm cold."
Moving closer to the fire, Denshiro squatted, almost hugging it. Since no one could remember a time, morning, noon, or night, when he had appeared at the dojo not smelling of alcohol, his drinking had come to be accepted as a matter of course. Though the fate of the whole Yoshioka school was at stake, one man wondered fuzzily if it wouldn't be better for him to warm his body with a little sake than to try to wield the sword with freezing arms and legs. Another quietly pointed out that it would be risky to disobey him, even for his own good, and a couple of the men ran off to the tea house. The sake they brought was piping hot.
"Good," said Denshiro. "My very best friend and ally."
They watched nervously as he imbibed, praying he wouldn't consume as much as usual. Denshiro, however, stopped well short of his normal quota. Despite his show of nonchalance, he well knew that his life was in the balance.
"Listen, could that be Musashi?"
Ears pricked up. As the men around the fire rapidly got to their feet, a dark figure appeared around the corner of the building. He waved his hand and shouted,
"Don't worry, it's only me."
Though gallantly attired, with his hakama tucked up for running, he could not disguise his age. His back was bent into the shape of a bow. When the men could see him more clearly, they informed each other that it was only the old man from Mibu, and the excitement died down. The old man was Yoshioka Genzaimon, Kenpo's brother and Denshiro's uncle.
"Why, if it isn't Uncle Gen, what brings you here?"
exclaimed Denshiro. It had not occurred to him that his uncle might consider his assistance needed tonight.
"Ah, Denshiro," said Genzaimon, "you're really going through with it. I'm relieved to find you here. I meant to go and discuss the matter with you first, but discuss? What is there to discuss? The Yoshioka name has been dragged through the mud. Your brother's been made a cripple. If you'd taken no action, you'd have had me to answer to. There's nothing to worry about. I'm not weak-kneed like my brother." "I'll take your word for that. And I know you'll win. But I thought I'd better come and give you some encouragement. I ran all the way from Mibu. Denshiro, let me warn you. You shouldn't take this opponent too lightly from what I hear."
"I'm aware of that."
"Don't be in too much of a hurry to win. Be calm. Leave it to the gods. If by any chance you get killed, I'll take care of your body."
"Ha ha ha ha! Come, Uncle Gen, warm yourself by the fire."
The old man silently drank a cup of sake, then addressed the others reproachfully.
"What are you doing here? Certainly you don't intend to back him up with your swords, do you?
This match is between one swordsman and another, and it looks cowardly to have a lot of supporters around. It's almost time now. Come with me, all of you. We'll go far enough away so it doesn't look as though we were planning a mass attack.
The men did as they were commanded, leaving Denshiro alone. He sat close to the fire, thinking,
"When I heard the bells, it was 8 o'clock. It must be 9 by now.
Musashi's late."
The only trace of his disciples was their black footprints in the snow. The only sound, the crack of icicles breaking off the eaves of the temple. Once, the branch of a tree snapped under the weight of the snow. Each time the silence was disturbed, Denshiro's eyes darted about like a falcon's. And like a falcon, a man came kicking through the snow. Nervous and panting, Hyosuke said between breaths, "He's coming!" Denshiro knew the message before he heard it and was already on his feet.
"He's coming?"
he asked parrot-like, but his feet were automatically stamping out the last embers of the fire. Hyosuke reported that Musashi had taken his time after leaving the Ogia, as if oblivious of the heavy snowfall.
"Just a few minutes ago, he climbed the stone steps of the Gion Shrine. I took a back street and came as fast as I could, but even dawdling the way he was, he couldn't be far behind me. I hope you're ready."
This is it.
Kyosuke, get away from here.
Where are the others?
I don't know, but I don't want you here. You make me nervous.
Yes, sir. Kyosuke's tone was obedient, but he did not want to leave and made up his mind not to. After Denshiro had trampled the fire into the slush and turned with a tremor of excitement toward the courtyard, Kyosuke ducked under the floor of the temple and squatted in the darkness. Though he had not particularly noticed the wind out in the open, here underneath the building it whipped frigidly. Chilled to the bone, he hugged his knees and tried to deceive himself into thinking that the chattering of his teeth and the painful shiver running up and down his spine came from the cold alone and had nothing to do with his fear. Denshiro walked about 100 paces from the temple and took a solid stance, bracing one foot against the root of a tall pine tree and waiting with palpable impatience. The warmth of the sake had worn off rapidly, and Denshiro felt the cold biting into his flesh. That his temper was growing shorter was evident even to Hyosuke, who could see the courtyard as clearly as if it were daylight. A pile of snow cascaded off the branch of a tree. Denshiro started nervously. Still, Musashi did not appear. Finally, unable to sit still any longer, Hyosuke came out of his hiding place and shouted, "What happened to Musashi?"
"Are you still here?"
Denshiro asked angrily, but he was as irritated as Hyosuke and did not order him away. By tacit mutual consent, the two walked toward each other. They stood there, looking around in all directions, time and again one or the other saying, "I can't see him." Each time the tone grew both angrier and more suspicious.
"That bastard! He's run away!"
exclaimed Denshiro.
"He couldn't have," insisted Hyosuke, launching into an earnest recapitulation of all he had seen and why he was sure Musashi would eventually come.
Denshiro interrupted him.
"What's that?"
he asked, looking quickly at one end of the temple. A candle was emerging shakily from the kitchen building behind the long hall. It was in the hands of a priest, that much was clear, but they could not make out the dim figure behind him. Two shadows and the speck of light passing through the gate between the kitchen and the main building ascended the long veranda of the Sanju Sangendo. The priest was saying in a subdued voice,
"Everything here is shut up at night, so I can't say. This evening there were some samurai warming themselves in the courtyard. They may have been the people you're asking about, but they're gone now, as you can see."
The other man spoke quietly. "I'm sorry to have intruded while you were asleep."
"Ah, aren't there two men over there under that tree? They may be the ones who sent word they'd wait for me here." "Well, it wouldn't do any harm to ask them and see.
I'll do that. I can find my way by myself now, so please feel free to go back to your room.
Are you joining your friends for a snow viewing party?
Something like that, said the other man with a slight laugh.